Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. Today we bring you the second part of our two-part interview with Dr. Ron Messier, former director of the Honors Program and professor emeritus of history. The subject is Jesus as a locus for dialogue between Muslims and Christians, the subject of a forthcoming book. An expert on Middle East issues, Messier is known widely on and off campus for his archaeological digs in Morocco. He was a professor of Middle East history and historical archaeology at MTSU from 1972 to 2004, winning the university's Outstanding Teacher Award in 1976, Outstanding Honors Faculty Award in 1978, and Outstanding Research Award in 1997, as well as the Council for the Advancement and Support of Education Award as Tennessee Teacher of the Year in 1993. He earned his bachelor's degree from the University of Rhode Island in 1966 and his master's and doctorate from the University of Michigan in 1968 and 1972, respectively.
The other book you were working on is about Jesus as a jumping-off point for discussions between Christians and Muslims.
Yeah, more than a jumping-off point, actually, and I don't have a title for it yet. Well, I do, but I don't like the title, so I'm not going to use it.
Just a working title.
Yes, but what I'm thinking, what the book is about is Jesus as a locus for dialogue. So it's more than just a jumping-off point. It's really the focus of, can be, the focus of dialogue between Muslims and Christians.
And the difference between literal truth or accepting something as literal truth and contextual truth, which is a way to explain some scriptures in both the Bible and the Quran that people in the other religions have found troublesome over the years.
Yeah, so you're thinking about the section in the introduction where I talk about different kinds of truths.
Right.
Yeah, and I don't think I would use the term literal truth. I mean, I did talk
or
about different
scientific
kinds of truth.
Truth.
Right, factual truth on the one hand, and factual truth is truth that things that we know to be true as a result of empirical evidence, right? I mean, we see this, and a number of people have seen this, and consequently they agree that it's true.
Right.
That's one kind of truth. Mythical truth is what I sort of contrast to that. And mythical truth is not based on empiricism at all. And I gave a couple of examples, as you'll remember.
Right.
The events on Mount, and this is how I came up with the idea, actually. I read a book entitled The Sinai Myth. So the events on Mount Sinai.
Moses getting the Ten Commandments.
Moses getting the Ten Commandments. Is that true? Well, in a sense, it's true. Does it have historical truth? Well, we could ask historical questions about Moses, couldn't we? And typical historical questions would be these. When did this happen? Well, we don't know when that happened exactly. We have at least a 300-year window of time when the events on Mount Sinai could have taken place. Second historical question, where did it happen? Well, we don't know that either. There are at least three places in the Sinai Peninsula that could be Mount Sinai.
Right.
And it could be any one of them. I mean, there's the one at the one just behind the monastery of St. Catherine is the one that I prefer because it's such a spectacular place. If God appeared anywhere, that ought to be it. but we don't know for sure if it's that mountain or one of at least two others. And if we ask the historical question, how did it all happen? Well, we don't really know that either. If Moses would have had a tape recorder, would it have recorded anything? Well, I mean, does God have vocal cords? Did Moses actually hear vocal cords? We don't know the answers to those questions. So we have to ask a different type of question. What is the mythical truth of that? And the mythical truth it sort of points to what is the significance of whatever happened on Mount Sinai? And we can answer that. And the significance is that from that point on, whenever that point was, the Hebrew nation had a very different kind of relationship with God, based on a sense of law, and that's observable.
These
that we know.
Moral concepts were encoded into law.
Exactly. And so that is, that's a kind of truth.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very, and I would describe both truths as literal.
Regardless
historical truth is literal and mythical truth is literal. They're both true.
Regardless of whether anything actually got inscribed onto stone tablets or not. I mean, it's still certain truths to be dealt with.
Yeah.
And then there is contextual truth, which helps to explain certain Bible verses. For example, I am the way, the truth, and the light. You don't get to heaven unless you know me, as Jesus Christ said. Put it in the context of the moment and of the times.
Yeah, yeah. Who was Jesus talking to at that moment? Is the kind of question one would have to ask. Mm-hmm. And the answer, of course, he was talking to a very specific group of people. And the degree to which what he said is true for everyone else, mm-hmm. is not terribly clear.
And then there are certain Bible verses, not Bible verses, Quran verses that Christians find troubling outside of their proper context. And you mentioned some of those as well.
Yeah. Can you recall which ones you had?
Let me see. Well, I'll look for them.
Yeah, well, you're probably thinking of the verses that call for, aggression against the infidel.
There is that. There is also the begetting question, the definition of begetting. Is it not befitting to the majesty of God that he should beget a son in Quran 19:35?
But yeah,
do the Muslims define begetting the same way that Christians define begetting, as a birth, a literal birth?
Muslims have a great deal of difficulty getting beyond a biological definition for the term beget.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's inconceivable for them for God to engage in the physical act of begetting. And consequently, now having said that, I don't think Christians could get beyond, they can get beyond a physical definition of it, which is why they can use the term. But if Muslims and Christians used the term beget exactly in the same way, I think they would be in agreement about God begetting a son. In other words, I mean, did you get this point? I don't think that Christians, when they use the term Jesus is the only begotten son, that they believe that God slept with the Virgin Mary in order for Jesus to be born.
It was the birth of an idea. It was the birth of a religion. It was the birth of a faith. It was not a literal consummation of a physical relationship.
Well, it was not a physical act that on the part of God that brought it. It was an act of the will of God.
Right.
In fact, the Muslims do believe that, and Muslims, the Quran specifically, says that Jesus was born of the Virgin Mary as a result of an act of the will of God. And so when taken that way, what they say about that is pretty much, as I understand, Christians believing the same notion about the virgin birth.
Okay. There was another Quran verse that says, they, the Jews, meaning the Jews, killed him, Jesus, nor crucified him, but so it was made to appear to them.
Right. And this is in reference to the crucifixion, of course. And it's the only verse in the Quran that addresses the crucifixion. And the crucifixion is one of the most easily confused issues or divisive issues between Christianity and Islam. And so the question that I raise with respect to that verse is, what does that verse require Muslims to believe? And literally what it requires Muslims to believe is that the Jews did not kill Jesus. Now, having said that, most Muslims, and by most Muslims I mean something more than half, deny the crucifixion on the basis of that verse, although the verse doesn't require that.
Deny that it took place at all?
That's right. Most Muslims would say that the crucifixion, no, they believe that the crucifixion took place, but the explanation is that it was not Jesus who was crucified, it was a substitute.
I see.
Who was crucified in his stead. So that's the most common belief.
Okay.
But that's not what the verse says. What the verse says is that the Jews did not crucify Jesus. Let me tell you this anecdote.
Okay.
This is how I got onto this particular thought. I was riding in a train one day with one of my Muslim colleagues, a very pious Muslim, and we were riding from Casablanca to Marrakesh, and we got to a certain point where he said, "No, we need to be quiet now because I want to do my prayers." So I respected that, and he said his prayers, but then the thought occurred to me, okay, he's finished his prayers now, he's ripe for this discussion. And so I said, "Abdullah, do you know the verse in the Quran that addresses the crucifixion?" And he thought for a minute, and then he recited it, you know, from memory. Mm-hmm. And I said, "No, it's interesting." I said, "Now, could you back up a verse?" And he recited the verse, incidentally, that you just read in English. And then I said, "Could you back up a verse?" And he did. And it's when he did that that it occurred to him that the pronoun "they" claimed to have killed him, but killed him not. It occurred to him that the pronoun "they" referred to the Jews. So then he sort of hit his head like this, and he said, "Oh, this raises a totally different question. The question is not whether or not Jesus was crucified, but who crucified him?"
Who do you blame? Do you blame the Jews? Do you blame Pontius Pilate?
Precisely. Now, there are Muslim theologians. There's one in particular, Mustafa Kamil Hussein, Hussein Kamil. No, I had it right the first time. Mustafa Kamil Hussein, he's an Egyptian theologian who wrote a book about this, and his idea is that everyone who's ever done an evil thing is responsible for the crucifixion. I mean, we're all responsible for the crucifixion, so it's not the Jews who killed him, we all did.
That's ironic,
and
because...
And so one could answer the question that now came to Abdullah's mind, well, we're all responsible, it's not the Jews, and so the Quranic phrase is correct. They claim to have killed him, but they killed him not. We all did.
That is ironic for two reasons. For one thing, the Quran saying that the Jews did not kill him would put a would come as a shock maybe to some Jews who think that Muslims are anti-Semitic somehow,
or that Christians are anti-Semitic. I mean,
right.
This is a great argument. This would be a great argument. I don't know if Mel Gibson ever thought of it when people accused him of being anti-Semitic when he made his film.
Well, that's the second irony, because when he made The Passion of the Christ and he was going on the circuit plugging his movie, he claimed that what he was trying to communicate was that we all killed Christ.
That's exactly the point. And that's the point that can be made and is made by some Muslim theologians, albeit not a majority. Now, I had this other interesting experience. I was giving a talk on Jesus as a locus for dialogue between Muslims and Christians. It was an interesting weekend, actually, because I gave exactly the same lecture on a Saturday night in a mosque in Alexandria, Virginia, and then the following morning in a church. Same lecture, exactly the same lecture. And when I did it in the mosque, I got to this point talking about the crucifixion. Well, first of all, before I started talking about anything, I said to the group, and there were about 120 people in the congregation, I said, "Now I'm going to be making some statements about what I think you people believe. And I would really appreciate it if you could tell me, you know, in the dialogue, and you know, you can interrupt me and you know, we can have a dialogue, but I want you to tell me if it is in fact what you believe. I don't want to be putting words in your mouth. So when I say something, this is what I think you believe. You know, I wish you would tell me if that's true or not." So we get to this part about the crucifixion, and then I asked, I said, "Okay, how many of you believe that Jesus was crucified?" Now, about 120 people in the room, right?
Yeah.
Dead silence. And when I used to teach, I learned that patience in conducting a discussion is a virtue, right? So I didn't go any further. I just waited. And finally, a man somewhere in the middle of the crowd raised his hand, one person, said, "Well, I believe that Jesus was crucified." And then a second person, and a third, and about, well, I don't know, maybe 10 people. Big crowd, but at least 10 of them were willing to say that, "Yes, I believe Jesus was crucified." And then we could go on from there to talk about these other aspects here, about who was responsible and so on.
Why do you think that they were so hesitant to express themselves?
Well, because it's certainly not a majority position among Muslims.
Would they have been ostracized or looked askance at by their peers?
No, I don't think so. They weren't. Islam is a much more flexible religion than it appears on the outside.
Actually. Well, that's why I'm wondering, what would they have to fear by expressing the minority viewpoint?
Well, I think it's a very human tendency to be a little bit reluctant to be different than all of your peers.
Okay, so it just boils down to that, basically.
Yeah. I mean, they were certainly not ostracized. I mean, they were part of the community. I mean, I was with these people. We had a huge reception afterward, and they were part of the dialogue and discussion and community as I'm sure they continue to be today. That's not an issue. I mean, most Muslims, people feel that people are free to believe what they believe. I mean, there's, in fact, the Quran is explicit about that. There is no coercion in religion. That's what the Quran says. Now you're going to say, okay, so why do we see coercion in different parts of the Muslim world? Well, because some people, leaders, some religious leaders, some political leaders do believe in coercion. Okay. The Almoravids believed in coercion.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that that's what the Quran stands for or that's what the religion stands for.
Does the Quran have anything to say about the necessity of man's governance of himself to be a theocracy? Does a theocracy need necessarily be theocratic, this combination of God and government, which we strive to separate in the United States, Western democracies?
No, the Quran does not demand a theocracy in that sense.
Okay. So that is a man-made construct of combining the two.
Yeah.
Basically. Mm-hmm. Why do we of all faiths tend to sometimes not delve into the contextual truth? Are we just being intellectually lazy? Is that why we choose to be literalists, some of us?
Oh, I don't know.
Because it takes time and effort to explore contextual truth, right?
Well, I don't know how to answer that question.
If you don't know the context, you have to investigate the context and find out what it was in order to view it.
I think different people would have a
totality.
Lot of different reasons for what trying to have their own view carry the day or to impose their view on someone else. People have different reasons for doing that. I think it boils down to, most of us have a tendency to think that what I believe is correct. Otherwise, we wouldn't believe that, right?
You wouldn't have
ego. We'd believe something else. So the question is, I guess, to what extent do you want to go to impose your belief on someone else? And people have different views on that. I mean, I would never try to impose my view on someone else.
And when you talk about using Jesus as a locus for discussion between Christians and Muslims, are the kinds of Christians and Muslims you're likely to get into the discussion people who are already of a mindset to be free in the exploration of kinds of ideas?
Absolutely. This notion only works well with people who are reasonably open-minded mm-hmm. and open to exploration, open to questioning their own thoughts and their own beliefs. Yeah, I mean, it requires someone who's open-minded for this to work, I think, this kind of dialogue to work. Now, having said that, I mean, I can go back to my friend Abdullah, whom I described as a very pious Muslim, and he is. But he's an academic, he's willing to ask himself, why do I really believe this? And incidentally, I don't think that I when I raise these kinds of questions with people like Abdullah, my goal is not to change their minds.
Right.
To help them understand what they understand, maybe in a different light, or to understand it more thoroughly.
The whole point is that you are not proselytizing. You are not mm-hmm. attempting to convert anybody, nor is he attempting to convert you. Mm-hmm. This is a discussion about ideas.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And you know, my own ideas have become my own understanding of who Jesus is, mm-hmm. for example, my own Christian idea, and I would certainly describe my idea as a Christian one, has become much clearer as a result of this book that I've now been working on for, gosh, a very mm-hmm. long time, 7 years, I guess.
How do Muslims view Jesus as an historical figure? How important was he?
Extremely important. And the Quran is very explicit. The Quran mentions Jesus about 30 times, so he's prominent in the Quran. The Quran describes Jesus as a great teacher, as a prophet, as a man empowered by the Holy Spirit, as a man who was miraculously born of a virgin birth, of a man who was able to perform miracles, who did perform miracles. And they don't describe the miracles because they assume that they've already been described by the Bible, so they believe in the Bible. Mm-hmm. There is one miracle, actually, that is in the Quran that is not in the Bible, and that's this miracle where Jesus created birds out of clay, and then he breathed on the clay birds and they flew away. And that to me is an interesting one because it suggests that Jesus had creative power. He had the power to create life.
Right.
And Muslims believe that. So, I've never met a Muslim. I think it's inconceivable that any Muslim would ever say that Jesus is God. But they do believe that Jesus is an extraordinary prophet. Not, you know, so we say he's just a prophet. He wasn't just a prophet. He was an extraordinary prophet. And in some ways, a greater prophet than the prophet Muhammad. And at least in this sense, the Quran describes Jesus as the only human being born without sin. And Muslims do have this concept of the perfect human. Mm-hmm. The Arabic term, our Arabic term is al-insan al-kamil, the perfect man. And although many Muslims describe al-insan al-kamil as the Prophet Muhammad, they do so, I think, Muhammad being more of an archetypal figure than a real person.
Mm-hmm.
And this perfect human in the Islamic concept is someone who's perfect in the sense that embodies all of the attributes of God. And so one could raise the question, if many Muslims leave that perfect human unidentified, could it be Jesus? Because they do describe Jesus as conceived without sin, born without sin.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the questions that I often raise with Muslim intellectuals. Could this perfect human that the Quran talks about and Muslim tradition talks about, could it conceivably be Jesus?
We have not had perfect people since. However, we know that some of the figures recognized by the Catholic Church as saints, for example, were nowhere near perfect. Saint Augustine was a real party animal mm-hmm. until he decided to come to Christ. And so we believe that people are redeemed, that they can be redeemed. The Muslims believe in redemption as well, that someone can turn their life around.
Yes.
That it is possible to go from living an inappropriate life to living one of greater virtue.
Yeah, and I think Muslims believe that the agent for redemption is the Quran. So one is saved by living one's life, structuring one's life in accordance with what the Quran teaches and what the Quran says. And so sometimes, I mean, from time to time you hear people saying that The Quran is to Islam what Jesus is to Christianity, the salvation agent.
Mm-hmm.
And if one is willing to think in those terms, in Christianity we call it incarnation, the Word became flesh.
Mm-hmm.
In Islam we call it in liberation, the Word became a book. And in the case of Christianity, Jesus is the salvation agent. In the case of Islam, the Quran is the salvation agent.
Right. If the discussions that we hope to take place between Christians and Muslims are occurring with people who are already inclined to be open-minded, then how do those of us of Christian and Muslim faith, those of us of all faiths, those of us who want to see greater understanding among all different kinds of peoples, reach those who are less inclined to be open-minded?
How do you do it? Yeah. It's a great question, and I don't know that I know the answer, but I raised that question. The summer before last, I was in Turkey on an interfaith dialogue mission, and one of the places that I went with a small group of people, a few other people from Murfreesboro and Nashville, we were at this foundation for journalists and writers, and this foundation was inspired by the teachings of a man named Fethullah Gulen, a Turkish intellectual, who preaches interfaith dialogue, mutual understanding. The better we get to know people of different faiths and different cultures, the more we can respect them without losing our own sense of identity, the better the world is going to be. Well, that's a pretty simple, straightforward message. It's a lot easier to pull it off than it is to say it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the question that I put to this author at this Writers Foundation. I said, okay, so you're telling us this, you're preaching to the choir. I mean, we believe in universal dialogue too. That's what we're doing here. How do you convey this message to people less inclined? And his answer was, this is a Muslim writer now. His answer was, are you ready?
Yeah.
His answer was, through example and humility, just like when Jesus washed the feet of his disciples. And I go, wow.
That's a powerful moment.
Is dialogue possible?
How are we doing since 9/11, in the post-9/11 world? There have been some knee-jerk moments in all kinds of countries, some reactionary moments in this country. There have been some ugly words said and some ugly deeds done against people of the Muslim faith. Have we made any progress in getting past that toward having a calm, reasoned, intelligent discussion of the things that divide us and the things that bring us together?
Oh, I believe so. I think in the aftermath of 9/11, and I'm not sure if we're, well, in the immediate aftermath, there was a very, very strong desire on the part of people all over the world to learn more about Islam and for Muslims to learn more about us. I think that's faded somewhat since the immediate aftermath of 9/11, but it certainly hasn't gone away. I continue to be asked often, well, you know, in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, I gave at least one public service lecture about Islam somewhere at least once a week for at least 2 years. Thank goodness it's less frequent now, actually, because that took quite an effort to do that. But I still get a lot of requests to talk about the nature of Islam and to try to explain Islam to people. So yeah, I think there's definitely a desire for what? Better mutual understanding. It doesn't always work. And there are individuals, for whatever reason, and I don't understand all of the reasons why there are individuals that that block dialogue and block reconciliation on both sides. I mean,
this is not
a unidirectional thing here.
Right. Do you think it would be any easier if more of our communities had, more of our towns and cities had thriving Muslim communities? We have an Islamic center here in Murfreesboro, but if there were more, say, Dearborn, Michigan, mm-hmm. for example, where there is a thriving, vibrant Islamic community, would interaction be more more likely, or would we just segregate ourselves into our separate units?
I'm going to guess that it would be more likely. I mean, what I tell people here is, you want to know what Islam's about. I mean, you have Muslim neighbors. Introduce yourself to your Muslim neighbors. Get to know them.
Invite them to come speak to the Rotary Club.
No, just say hello to them in the grocery store.
Yeah.
And what you discover is that they're normal people. They're people just like us. And the reverse is true. So I think if you can just have dialogue, even at the simplest, most superficial level, it facilitates getting along.
Well, the reason I asked the question is because I was raised in a small southern town in which the two ethnic groups were basically whites and African Americans, and yet I heard all of this falderal when I was a child from friends of my parents and so forth about the Jews this and the Jews that and the the Jews will cheat you out of, get price gouging and all kinds of stupid, horrible stereotypes. You've heard them a million times before. And I thought, how do you know? There's no Jewish community here in town. There's no synagogue. Where did you ever run into a Jewish person in your life? Or is this just something you heard somewhere?
Yeah, well, that's my point. So if you look at people from another culture as real human beings, if you simply are in a place where you can see them living ordinary lives, then you're much more likely to be able to interact.
You said that you had the Almoravid's book deadline was December, and it would be coming out sometime 8 months into next year. What's your state of progress on the Jesus book?
Well, I have 7 out of 9 chapters completed, so I envision 9 chapters. 7 of them are done. The 2 last chapters are relatively easy compared to the ones that I've done so far.
You know how the story ends, anyway.
Well, I do. I mean, I did from the beginning.
Yeah.
But still, writing about something like the Trinity in a way that both Christians and Muslims could look at it and talk about it together was not a very easy thing to do.
It is a complicated concept.
For Christians, and even more so for Muslims.
Yes.
But I think it's possible. But anyway, that chapter is finished, thank goodness. The chapters that I have left, I have a chapter on resurrection and the second coming. Relatively easy, actually, because the Quran does not deny the resurrection. I mean, the Quran says that Jesus was taken up to heaven.
Yes.
I mean, there are a lot of questions about exactly what that means, but at least it's there, and Muslims believe that Jesus
right.
was taken to heaven.
Well,
and they also believe that Jesus will come back at the time of the final judgment. So there's really relatively easy grounds for dialogue on that issue. So that's one chapter, the resurrection and the second coming. The final chapter is about how Muslims and Christians relate to God, and it's mostly about prayer. And the chapter will focus on a Muslim tradition which repeats the Lord's Prayer almost exactly word for word as Christians do.
We'll have to have you back to talk about it more fully after it's been written. Dr. Ron Massier, Professor Emeritus of History and former head of the Honors Program at MTSU. Thank you. This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're also available on iTunes.